You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up on the show, we assess the UN's new role in the Democratic Republic of Congo as an interventionist military force launches an offensive this weekend against M23 rebels.
Plus, we'll be heading to Finland to find out what some of the biggest names in design were doing there this weekend.
And in a preview of this week's culture, we head to Edinburgh to review some of the highlights from the Fringe Festival.
A kitsch 1950s tale with giant crickets, magical snails, and a dubstep soundtrack.
You're nothing like any boy I ever seen. You've got nothing in that head of yours but wood.
Exciting stuff. All that plus, we'll be setting the day's agenda with a special guest in this studio, and we'll also play some music as well, hopefully not snail dubstep. But that's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So a very busy 60 minutes up ahead, but before all that, here is Mr. Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Syria's President Assad has warned America that failure awaits it if it attacks his country in the wake of last week's chemical weapons attack in a Damascus suburb. Hundreds of people are believed to have died in the attack, which, if confirmed, would be the world's worst chemical weapons attack in 25 years. President Assad says Western claims that his troops were responsible are politically motivated. The US says Syria's offer to let UN inspectors visit the site of the alleged attack has come too late to be credible. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is calling on Washington to show restraint. The UN experts are in Damascus, and Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says they must be allowed to find the truth.
Success is in everyone's interest, all parties in Syria, and all concerned states. It will address the recent allegations in the Damascus area, and its success can have a deterrent effect on possible further use of chemical weapons in Syria and elsewhere. We are determined to answer the call of our member states, fulfill our mandate, and resolve deeply disturbing, unanswered their questions.
The trial of the ousted former senior Chinese politician Bo Xilai has ended, with the verdict due at an unspecified later date, according to the state news agency. Bo's trial on charges of corruption, accepting bribes and abuse of power started on Thursday. Prosecutors are demanding a heavy sentence, saying Bo's whimsical challenge to the charges flew in the face of the evidence. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has arrived in Pakistan for talks expected to focus on what happens when most foreign troops pull out of his country next year and whether or not the Afghan Taliban will have a role. Pakistan is considered crucial to peace talks with the Islamist group. Karzai has said he'll ask Pakistan for the release of high-profile Taliban prisoners into Afghan government custody. The Taliban have so far refused to negotiate with the Afghan government, accusing them of being a puppet of the United States. A huge wildfire raging across the western edge of Yosemite National Park swept further into the park on Sunday, forcing the evacuation of some of its camps because of heavy smoke. The blaze is now within 2 miles of a key reservoir that supplies most of San Francisco's water. The so-called Rim Fire, which has burned 134,000 acres, has now forced the evacuation of 13 of the park's 74 camps, and the flames have consumed 15,000 acres inside Yosemite. The former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has claimed he's on the verge of dying from drug and alcohol problems. Speaking after his first fight as a boxing promoter at a resort in New York State, Tyson said he's trying to tackle his problems.
I went to my AA meeting and I had to make a discussion and check out what we're going to do. So I explained to my fellow alcoholics and junkies that I was going to deal with this certain situation here. And I explained the feeling that I evoked from it. I made myself proud of me. I hate myself. I'm trying to kill myself. I hate myself a lot, but I made myself proud of myself. And I don't do that much. And I was happy I did that.
Officials at the National Zoo in Washington say a second panda cub, born within just over 24 hours, was stillborn and malformed. The first cub arrived on Friday evening and a second wasn't expected, but it was born on Saturday evening. Dr. Susan Murray is the zoo's chief veterinarian.
The stillborn cub was never alive, and it was malformed. Most of the malformations were limited to the head region. It was missing part of the skull, the eyes, the upper jaw, and most of the majority of its brain.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney. We'll see you in about 25 minutes or so. It's 5 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, dette Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We are live from Studio One in London this morning. As ever, we kick off the show with our agenda setter. That's when we call on an expert for three big stories that you need to know about for the rest of the day. Today, our focus is on Latin America, and we're joined in the studio by Brazilian journalist Bruno Garces. Wonderful to see you, Bruno. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start in Brazil, shall we?
Yes, well, a subject that is likely to make the headlines, stay on the headlines actually, in the next few days is the fact that Brazil is now importing doctors from Cuba who are renowned for their skills. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Brazilian doctors aren't. The fact is, Brazil is faces a deficit of specialized doctors in certain areas of the country. So it needs to bring foreign specialists in order to bridge that gap.
Is there a worry that if Cuban doctors come into Brazil at all, they won't necessarily stay in the areas that need it, and then they might usurp Brazilian doctors in other areas?
Well, I think there's the main concern, I think, is that Brazil, which comes from the Union of Doctors, is that Brazil shouldn't be turning to this practice. They've adopted a somewhat protectionist stance that Brazilians should be doing the job. But fact of the matter is that there are some downridden areas, some small towns, some impoverished parts of the country, which do not appeal to those who've just recently graduated or to those who've been in the job for quite a while. So you have a very uneven situation. While you have plenty of doctors in Rio and São Paulo, for instance, but none, let's say, in the heart of the Amazon in a small town over there. So that's why, at least, the claim of the government is why the Brazil is importing doctors from elsewhere.
And just building on the point that Clemency just made, there is the concern that some of these Brazilian some of these Cuban doctors, when their contract is up, that they may want to actually stay in Brazil and try to claim political asylum. The Cuban Attorney General and the Brazilian government saying that they would not be awarding these doctors political asylum in the country if they, for some reason, decide to stay.
Well, that's likely not to happen, in fact. I think they might even apply for asylum, but I think given what's at stake here, it would as well jeopardize relations between Brazil and Cuba in a way and worsen its already complex and delicate situation.
But the situation is not that there are no Brazilian doctors who can actually work in these areas. It's that, as you say, it's not so attractive to a young graduate doctor. So what's in it for the Cuban doctors? Why are they prepared to go to the areas that young Brazilian doctors aren't?
I think mainly for them, well, what happens is that wages tend not to be as attractive for Brazilians as they would be for the Cuban doctors. For the Cuban doctors, what's being offered is actually an appealing offer. But for the Brazilian ones, not that much. They'd rather try to make a career in a big urban area where they can profit more, where they can find a more promising career than to go to a place where it's far from any urban area. It's not very glamorous, to say the least. So that's, and while at the same time, a country facing severe crisis such as Cuba, what's being offered is much more tempting.
Let's move on, Bruno, to another topic which you've highlighted for us, this time over Cristina Kirchner over there in Argentina and her flagging popularity.
Yes, well, her popularity doesn't seem to stop dropping. Now there's even a close ally, which she had a meeting with the head of the Union of Public Transports, Ricardo Pignanelli. He said in an interview that she confided to him that she actually doesn't want to stand for re-election in 2015. Whether or not that's a fact remains to be seen, but what is a fact is that she faced a crushing defeat. Her and her party faced a crushing defeat in the very recent primary elections. Primary elections are some specificity of Argentine electoral law, which stipulates that this election be held in order to define what are the political parties apt to take part in national elections. In that election, her and her party, the Partido Justicialista, faced a crushing defeat. And now many people in Argentina believe that her future is at stake. And with that, the over more than a decade of peronismo would be at stake as well. This left-wing leaning government that she has presided and her husband Néstor Kirchner, the now passed away Néstor Kirchner, did as well.
Is that the main source of the disillusionment towards Kirchner economic? Obviously, inflation has been on the rise in Argentina. You look at the hike in the dollar in relation to the peso. Is that the main reason or are there others besides?
I think there's mainly that. And I think on the side, Cristina Kirchner has always been a very distant figure. She is charismatic, but she doesn't talk to the press. She puts herself in a bit of a pedestal. So I think that doesn't help much. I think she's this very distant, somewhat mysterious figure. I recall years ago when I was in Washington and she was there to take part in a summit. And there were security guards surrounding her to make sure that we, the reporters, didn't approach her at all. Mm. So I think that posture doesn't help much.
And of course, in certain times when there are domestic problems, an example there in Spain, obviously that country experiencing some tough economic situations, the leader there, Rajoy, tends to use foreign issues to try to gain a bit of popularity. I'm talking now, of course, of Gibraltar. Kirchner and the Falkland Islands, a big issue for her, trying to play up that angle. Has that not helped her in the popularity back at home?
Apparently, it always does in Argentina. I think all the leaders always come up with the Falklands card, or Malvinas, as they call it there. It's a uniting topic in Argentina. You know, it unites left and right, and it's claiming sovereignty to the islands has been on the agenda for quite a while, and it has started with the military governments and carried on through the left-wing administrations. So yes, it's something to cling on, most likely.
Let's move over to Colombia and the latest violence between the government and FARC. Not necessarily a surprising story, but there has been a tentative peace process. Is this a major setback?
Yes, there's. It's another violent incident in this decades-long struggle between government and the left-wing rebels. And it might, in fact, threaten the peace negotiations, which were currently being held. President Juan Manuel dos Santos had been pushing for that. He had been calling for a more soft stance than his predecessor, Álvaro Uribe, who still is very vocal against these negotiations. But this setback, which I'm mentioning, was caused by an attack launched on Saturday in the department of Arauca, in which 14 soldiers were killed. Unfortunately, this is not new. It happens precisely a month after another attack had killed 15 members of the military forces. So whether or not these acts of violence will completely derail the whole process is what we have to see. It's also, it could as well be that there are factions within the left-wing rebels that are against the negotiations and that there might be a divide within their fields. We've seen that, you know, we saw that years ago in Ireland when there was a different branch of the IRA which condemned any form of negotiation. So we could be seeing something similar. That it's not unprecedented.
And of course, the FARC rebels saying that any deal that they do agree to, they would put that to a referendum.
Yes, there's that as well. But how you call that, how you put that under a referendum, being a clandestine, so to speak, group, which they're not going to call national elections. So it's it's intriguing how, what shape or form that would take.
Bruno Gar says we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, as ever, for being with us here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up, we head to the DRC to assess the UN's role of interventionist military force in Goma.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Phil Hahn. The escalating unrest in the Democratic Republic of Congo stands out not just for the ferocity of the attacks on Goma by M23 rebel forces, but also for the fact that the United Nations is now playing the role of interventionist military force in the country's volatile east. That's in addition to the 18,000 soldiers already stationed on the ground to protect civilians under the UN mission MONUSCO.
Some 3,000 further soldiers are in the DRC with a mandate to neutralize rebel fighters responding to enemy shelling in kind by launching an offensive over the weekend that has targeted positions near the eastern city. Well, to discuss this further, we're joined on the line by our correspondent, Tristan McConnell. Tristan, welcome to the program. Give us a sense of exactly what mandate this UN force will have.
Well, the new UN Intervention Brigade has a very specific mandate that really allows them to be much more aggressive than the other 17,000 or so peacekeepers who are in eastern Congo at the moment. And their job really is to essentially hunt down and disarm rebel groups. And that specifically includes the M23 group, which you mentioned, but others as well. There are literally dozens of militia groups around eastern Congo who've been preying upon civilians for years. And the aim of this intervention brigade is to put an end to that and really go on the front foot and attack these groups and forcibly, if necessary, forcibly disarm them.
Tristan, how much faith is there amongst the citizens of Goma and eastern Congo that the intervention brigade will actually be a significant addition to that UN force, which after all just stood by when M23 captured Goma late last year?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there is not a great deal of goodwill towards the UN sort of blue helmet peacekeepers in Goma at the moment. Only on Saturday, when mortar came in and landed in one of the western suburbs of town, there were very quickly protests, and when the UN vehicles drove by, they were stoned with rocks and so on. And look, it's not exactly, specifically the fault of the UN peacekeepers if a mortar lands in town, but you can see the way people react is to blame the UN for not, protecting their lives and property in a better way. And as you said, in November, they simply stood by as the M23 rebels rolled into Goma. So even though this intervention brigade has arrived now and is beginning to be deployed, I think the jury is very much out on whether they're going to have any greater effect. And certainly people in Goma are not, are not expecting anything great from the intervention brigade any more than they do from the standard peacekeepers.
And Tristan, many people pointing the finger to Rwanda and particularly the government in Kigali over their perceived, I guess, backing of the M23 rebels. What can you tell us about Rwanda's role in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's been a lot of allegations made over the last sort of last 16 months or so since the rebellion began, of Rwandan support to the M23 rebels. And a lot of the evidence really is very strong. If you look at the investigation that's done by a UN team called the Group of Experts, there's a lot of very, very powerful evidence there. Human Rights Watch and other groups have also compiled their own evidence. Journalists have done their own research. Rwanda dismisses all of these allegations, but doesn't really provide very good countering evidence, if you like. And the most recent thing we've seen was just at the weekend, the U.S. State Department put out another statement, again, sort of reiterating its call for Rwanda to cease any and all support to the M23. So Rwanda's sort of denials are falling on deaf ears. But what it does look like on the ground, at least in Congo, is that M23 is not enjoying the kind of support that it had last year from Rwanda, which, according to eyewitnesses and others, included the Rwandan army crossing the border and joining in on their side shortly before the takeover of Goma. And that kind of thing does not seem to be happening right now. But there is very little doubt that at the least Rwanda is offering sort of tacit support to the M23 at the moment.
Tristan, peace talks in neighbouring Uganda have repeatedly stalled. M23, they've vowed to fight back against this supplementary UN force. Is there any hope for imminent peace in the eastern Congo? If that's not too naive a question.
I don't think so, no. I think, it's hard to have peace talks when you're also fighting a war. And as you said, the peace talks have been stalled and been kind of sputtering for the last month without any real progress. Even if you were to take out the M23, even if that's possible, that doesn't solve the problems of Eastern Congo, which have incredibly deep roots. And, it's not just about this one rebel group. As I said earlier, there are dozens of militias. But the problem here is that the Congolese state has no control really over its territory. Its army, although it's behaving better recently, has got a really horrible track record. I mean, in many cases, you're kind of better off being ruled by a rebel militia than by the Congolese army if you want to avoid being sort of, beaten or murdered or sort of pillaged. So, the problem is one of state failure. And into that sort of state control vacuum come any number of different forces, whether they are Rwandan-backed rebels or local militia groups or anyone else.
Tristan, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for your insights this morning. Our correspondent in East Africa, Tristan McConnell.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
This is Monaco 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-the-Hill. The time here in London is 8:23. Now, the place to be for all members of the design community this weekend was Jyväskylä, Finland, where the 7th Alvar Aalto Design Seminar was taking place.
With a theme this year entitled New Wave, leading design experts, teachers, professionals, students and enthusiasts from all around the globe were encouraged to think about whether signs of experimental change, similar to those in New Wave film and music, might be spotted in the design world too. Well, to tell us more, we're joined on the line now by Harry Coxinen, chair of the Alvar Aalto Design Seminar. A very good morning to you, Harry.
Very good morning.
Thank you for being with us. So first of all, why did you decide upon this theme, New Wave, for this year's design seminar?
I came across about this theme, New Wave, of course, from the Franz Fiedler and the new wave music in the late 70s. And of course, they like the loose idea on there was that is there any sort of happening in a design?
And Harry, another theme, I guess, for this festival was the role of technology in design. Now, that's something we talk quite a bit about, technology and design. But what are you guys doing a bit differently or trying to focus on a bit differently when you talk about technology's role in the evolution of design?
But that is really fundamental, of course, since the new technologies, they are really bringing something like new perspectives for doing things. And they are really helping us to create something fundamental for the near future challenges, of course.
Can you tell us more about the actual seminar itself? What were the kind of who are the sort of luminaries that you had there this weekend?
We had a great bunch of speakers, of course, over there. We had Sam Hecht and Alice Rostone and Marco Ahtisaari and great people around the world, and it was really fascinating weekend. One of the most intensive and educative what I ever had.
And I know for these types of weekends, it can be, you know, it can be quite difficult to try to find something that really does stand out. But do you have one particular highlight from the festival that really stands out to you?
Yeah, of course. It was great to meet Alice first time. And like you know, she's a great design critic. And she was setting the boundaries for us in a way that how design can really disempower us in every aspect of our lives, and of course how design is inescapable, and of course how design is an agent of change, what's really important, and how it helps us to make sense of what is happening around, and of course how it turns it to our advantage in design.
Harry, I know that the International Design Seminar is held every 3 years, and it was originally set up as a discussion forum to keep alive the spirit of the functional and ecological design principle represented by Alvar Aalto. Can you tell us more about what that principle is?
Yeah, Alvar Aalto, of course, he was really into real life, so whatever he did, it was really for the people, and it was for the everyday life. So he had this like a great and deep understanding what the design and architecture is for. And of course, the idea of this seminar is to continue this great thinking and be really on the ground and make sense of what is happening.
We're going to have to leave it there. But Harry Koskinen, chair of the Alvar Aalto Design Seminar, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
Well, we have time for a quick song now before we head to the news. This is Hiatus Coyote with Nakamura.
Love you, I do.
That was Australia's highest coyote there with Nakamura. In the next half hour of the program, we'll be reviewing this morning's European front pages. We'll be checking in with our correspondent in Istanbul for the latest news there. And we'll also review some of the highlights from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
A kitsch 1950s tale with giant crickets, magical snails, and a dubstep soundtrack.
You're nothing like any boy I ever seen. You've got nothing in that head of yours but wood.
Well, it's hard to follow that one, really. He hasn't got any dubstep, but he has got news headlines from around the world. Here is Barney Burnham.
Thanks, Clemmy. President Assad has warned America that failure awaits it if it attacks Syria in the wake of last week's chemical weapons attack in a Damascus suburb. Hundreds of people are believed to have died. President Assad says Western claims that his troops were responsible are politically motivated. The trial of the ousted former senior Chinese politician Bo Xilai has ended, with the verdict due at an unspecified later date. Prosecutors are demanding a heavy sentence, saying Bo's whimsical challenge to the charges flew in the face of the evidence. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has arrived in Pakistan for talks expected to focus on what happens when most foreign troops pull out of his country next year and whether or not the Afghan Taliban will have a role to play. A huge wildfire raging across the western edge of Yosemite National Park swept further into the park on Sunday, forcing the evacuation of some of its camps because of heavy smoke. The blaze is now within 2 miles of a key reservoir that supplies most of San Francisco's water. The former heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson has claimed he's on the verge of dying from drug and alcohol problems. Speaking after his first fight as a boxing promoter at a resort in New York State, Tyson said he's trying to tackle his problems. Officials at the National Zoo in Washington say a second panda cub born within just over 24 hours was stillborn and malformed. The first cub arrived on Friday evening and is said to be in a robust condition. The second wasn't expected. It was born on Saturday evening. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 17:32 in Melbourne, it's 11:32 in Moscow, and 8:32 here in London.
Now, the magnificent city of Edinburgh has been fizzing with activity all month, with hundreds of thousands of people descending on the Scottish capital for the biggest international arts festival in the world. As ever, for performers, it's a frantic battle between venues for audiences and positive reviews. And for punters, it's a race against the clock to get a glimpse of even a fraction of what the festival has to offer.
Reporter Hazel Pfeiffer popped up there for a few days for tonight's culture show to soak up some of the energy and catch a few gems. Well, between improv comedy, original theatre and experimental music, she encountered clowns, cavemen, giant snails, beard playing, ukuleles and a few more kilts.
The Royal Mile sweeps majestically through the heart of Edinburgh's old town. The cobbled streets are filled with people handing out flyers, drama students in fancy dress heckling passers-by,
hilariously funny comedy,
and mini stages with a cappella groups bursting into song. The Edinburgh festivals are in full swing. International street performers from all over the world are competing for audiences and spare change, much to the amusement of the crowd.
Do you want to see me juggle three solid steel machetes on a 10-foot ladder?
Yeah!
Have you enjoyed the show so far?
Yeah!
Are you about to give me lots of money?
Yeah!
With juggling of a different kind, musician Adam Page doesn't play just one instrument, or even two or three. I counted 10. The saxophone, flute, harmony flute, keyboard, didgeridoo, guitar, and even his beard all feature as Adam bounces around the stage beatboxing and using loop pedals to meld the sounds into a one-man symphony.
So it takes a lot of thinking, but once I've put a loop down, I forget about that, you know, it's on to the next one. So it might seem like, wow, there's just so many things going on through your head, but it's really only one thing at a time.
While music, comedy and cabaret are everywhere, theatre is the real heart and soul of the festival. Edinburgh's Gothic architecture and dramatic fuse are an apt backdrop for some high-calibre thespian action, including Our Fathers, a deceptively simple play with subtle complexities by Birmingham group Babacus. The three main characters play themselves and intertwine their own personal relationships with their fathers into one poignant narrative, using multimedia, contemporary dance, and audience interaction to bring the story alive. Sophie Pachou is single and looking for a date. Mike Tweddle is faced with the unexpected prospect of being a father.
In the email, she told me about Gemma, a beautiful art curator in her late 30s who already has one child by an ex-husband but wants to have a second child, and no relationship has been forthcoming.
And Bert Hohmann is unreconciled with his religious father. I asked him how much personal material was in the play.
It's all personal material, but with little dramatic twists.
And the material that you use, so all the old photographs and the home videos, they're all from your own personal lives?
Yes, they are. And for me, it's kind of the first time I properly really absorbed them all. The diaries that my dad sort of left behind were just in a box, and I was always a bit nervous about looking at them. But once we realised we wanted to make a show about fatherhood, it was a way to explore them.
On the other side of town is Maysa Sobeihi, the first Saudi to perform in the Edinburgh festivals. In her student days, she became the first Saudi Arabian stand-up comedian and is now a playwright and champion of the dramatic arts in her country. Her play, Head Over Heels in Saudi Arabia, takes an upbeat look at marriage in the Gulf state, where men can have up to four wives.
It was just, you know, close to my heart and also close to an experience that I had gone through, because I lived in Saudi Arabia for many years as a divorced woman and a married woman and a mother. And I don't think a lot of people know what it is for women in Saudi Arabia to experience, or in the Arab world in general.
And how has the play been received in Saudi Arabia?
I mean, I think the people in Saudi Arabia like that and are thirsty for that. And I think there's a whole kind of genre of stand-up comedians coming up, evolving in Saudi Arabia because of that. That light entertainment is something I think they welcome.
Another performance that's standing out this year is Pants on Fire's dark version of the Disney classic Pinocchio. It's the wooden puppet story like you've never seen it. A kitsch 1950s tale with giant crickets, magical snails, and a dubstep soundtrack.
Like any boy I ever seen. You've got nothing in that head of yours but wood.
Jess Mabel-Jones is the show's artistic director.
We like to take classic stories and we like to turn them on their heads a bit.
Explain to me a bit about the commercials, because peppered in the story you've got these uber kitsch songs for commercials for everything from shampoo to bug spray.
That was to play with the consumerism of the 1950s. It's the first time where people started to have the money to be able to buy things, and things were made to break. The story itself is quite dark, the dubstep makes it quite heavy, and so we just wanted little moments of sort of frivolity and silliness for the sake of it.
As arts festivals go, Edinburgh is still the cultural World Cup. So if you're headed to the city in August, the best option is to get a front row seat and enjoy the action. For Monocle, in Edinburgh, I'm Hazel Pfeiffer.
Never heard snail dubstep before. Are you a fan, Clemency? You take me as a bit of a snail dubstep fan.
Yeah, I mean, I'm open to all forms of musical experimentation, Phil.
Good.
So I think I'm up for it.
Glad that you're open-minded.
I'm extreme. When it comes to music in particular, I'm extremely open-minded.
Good stuff. Well, that was Hazel Pfeiffer reporting for tonight's Culture Show. And if you want to hear more of that program, which includes an interview with author John Niven, a Midori House session from Australia's Emily Barker, and a trip to a Teletext art festival in Berlin, tune in at 1900 hours London time tonight. That's 1400 hours on the east coast of the United States and Canada.
Meanwhile, it is just coming up to 20 minutes to 9 in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Still to come, we hear what's making the front pages in Spain, France and Switzerland, and we will check in with our Istanbul correspondent, Caleb Lauer. Don't go anywhere.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibaken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London, and that makes it 10:40 in Istanbul, which is where we're going to head to now, because that's where we're going to find out what's making news in Turkey.
Indeed. Joining us on the line is our man by the Bosphorus, Caleb Lauer. Good morning, Caleb.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Great. Let's start with Syria, shall we? I mean, obviously the developments in that country are gripping the world since that chemical attack. But where does Turkey stand on all this?
That's right. Well, as many people will have heard, there was what appears to have been a chemical weapons attack in Damascus last week. And Doctors Without Borders has reported that at least hundreds of people have died in the attack, and other groups put the numbers much higher, you know, 1,000 people, etc. Many people are prepared to blame the Assad regime for this in the civil war that has consumed the country in the last 2 years. Now, Turkey is in a very critical position with this. Not only does it border Syria, but it is also one of the only major countries to come out in full support of the rebel opposition. So shortly after this attack, there was hundreds of tons of weapons reportedly shipped from depots in South Turkey by trucks to rebels in North Syria. But besides that, besides a very vocal condemnation from the Turkish government, this shipment of weapons has been the only real sort of material thing that we've seen in response to that chemical attack. Now, it's well known that Turkey supports the rebel opposition, but again, this shows, like other major developments in the past, such as the car bombing that happened earlier this spring at a border crossing, Turkey is really stuck in terms of what to do in Syria. It can't do much, but besides doing what it has been doing, which is to supply weapons and logistics to the rebels in North Syria, it has no real avenue to pursue in this. Turkey is simply in a terrible position. It wants an opposition victory, but on the other side of the table, Russia and Iran, two of Turkey's most important neighbors, which supply most of Turkey's energy, by the way, support Assad. America, which is Turkey's quote-unquote best ally, wants neither Assad nor the opposition to win and essentially wants both sides to lose. So you have a real sort of conundrum. Turkey is really, really stuck.
And absolutely, it's interesting that you note Russia there. Of course, Russia has its largest fleet based on the Mediterranean in the Syrian port town of Tartus. And of course, Turkey as well being a part of a NATO coalition, which potentially could strike within Syria. How much of a delicate balance is this for the government in Ankara to strike?
Well, this is crucial. I mean, the foreign policy debates that are discussed in America, let's say, are quite removed. America is thousands of miles away. Turkey is right in the center of what is becoming a face-off between NATO, America, Iran, and Russia. And of course, Turkey is right there in the middle. It doesn't want to alienate Russia. It doesn't want to further deteriorate its relations with Iran. But it also wants to get rid of Assad, not only as a prestige factor, but as a basic security factor. This civil war is a major security concern for Turkey, not just in terms of spillover violence like a car bombing, but in terms of its own domestic structure. The Syrian civil war is between Sunnis on one side and Alawites in Syrian context, but Turkey has a very similar social structure. And if things develop into sort of an overtly ethnic conflict, this will also affect the social tensions in Turkey.
Caleb, talking about tricky positions, let's move from politics to finance now and take a look at the Turkish lira. There's obviously been a rout in emerging markets recently, but what's been happening most recently with that currency?
Well, as you say, there's been a global rout, and a lot of emerging market currencies, like in India and Indonesia, have been falling, depreciating, mostly in response to what the American Federal Reserve is planning to do with its ending of quantitative easing. And this has also been affecting the lira. Last week, the lira reached essentially 2 liras to the dollar, which is the highest it's ever been. And this marks a major depreciation of the Turkish lira. This is Very important for a couple reasons, for more than a couple reasons, but two in particular. One is that Turkey buys more than it sells. It has a very, very big current account deficit, which basically means that it imports more than it exports, which means that especially in the world of energy, which contributes mostly to this account deficit, all that energy that Turkey is buying from abroad, every time the lira depreciates, it gets more and more expensive, which furthers this current account deficit, which increases inflation in the country. And inflation has been one of the major battles that the Turkish government has been fighting economically. It brought the country from decades of hyperinflation, high inflation, down to sort of single-digit inflation over the last 10 years or so. This type of depreciation of the lira really threatens that. The other thing it does is will make a raise in interest rates necessary. The Turkish Central Bank has limited foreign reserves to defend the currency, and so one of the only things it can do is to raise the interest rates. And this is going to be important because the economy is already slowing. Raising interest rates will reduce the investment and spending. And this is crucial not only because of what it'll do to the economy, but that we're entering a very, very crucial election season, and no government likes to see interest rates go up when they go into an election season.
And of course, one figure that many pundits are watching is that 10-year bond yield number. In the past years, looking at a yearly chart of the 10-year bond in Turkey, it hasn't climbed above 10%, that magic 10% number, until just the last couple of weeks. How devastating is this potentially for the Turkish economy?
Well, the thing with the bond yield is essentially an indication of how risky it is to loan money in a country, right? And so this is showing that the Turkish, there is an increased sensitivity of debt in Turkey. And one of the things that is becoming more apparent in the daily conversations of people is how much personal debt people have. Credit card debt is off the charts. People are taking credit from the bank just to pay their credit cards. Taking loans from the bank just to pay their credit cards. And so there's a real sense that debt, personal debt in the country, is becoming a real issue, which in an economy that is slowing down is quite worrying, let's say.
Caleb, just very briefly, tell us quickly one more story, a completely different flavour now altogether, archaeology and how archaeologists are racing against time.
Right. I saw two headlines in the last couple of days, which I thought were quite revealing about the state of archaeology in Turkey. And many people know that Turkey is one of the, in terms of human civilization, is one of the oldest places in the world. There is a dam that is due to be completed next year, which will inundate an entire area of archaeological sites of immense importance. And so archaeologists are trying to get to these artifacts, recover them before they are flooded and essentially removed from, the purview of researchers. But on the other hand, the Yenikapı archaeology site, which is in the center of Istanbul, is due to be sort of completed. This site was revealed by the construction of the Marmaray, the under Bosphorus rail line that is going to connect Asian and European Istanbul. And so what you have is the site was essentially revealed by accident by the construction. So you have these two things happening. In one hand, you have construction threatening to conceal these wonderful archaeological treasures. And on the other hand, you have construction actually revealing these wonderful archaeological treasures, which basically brings you back to the central point that in Turkey, construction seems to be everything.
Caleb Lauer, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed. Our correspondent in Istanbul. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Well, in just a moment, we'll be having a look through this morning's European front pages. But before we do, we have time for a bit of music. This is Vanessa Paradis, and this is Love Song.
That was Vanessa Paradis with Love Song. Well, it's Time now on Midori House to take a little look at the European newspapers with our researcher Alexa Feminich. Good morning, Alexa. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning.
It's lovely to see you. We're going to start with a story that sort of sounds funny, but in actual fact is not really very funny at all. It's about Switzerland and Zurich opening the country's first sex boxes. Tell us more.
Yes, so basically, starting as today, Zurich has introduced sex drive-ins in the northern part of the city, and it's basically an effort of the city to regulate the sex trade because, I mean, for people who don't know, they might be quite surprised. Switzerland's actually very open when it comes to their prostitution laws. We have some of the most liberal ones in the world, and because we believe that legalizing the practice prevents sexual exploitation. So what was happening in Zurich in the Silkway district was that sex workers were becoming a lot too open about their trade, and residents were complaining that their pavements were being taken over in the evenings and even during the afternoons.
And just looking at some images and video of this purpose-built block, I guess you could say, in this part of the country, it just seems very illogical that people are actually going to drive up and just park their cars in these little stalls next to one. So there's nine of these boxes, mm-hmm. aren't there? That they're just all going to park their cars and do their thing and then drive out? Very odd.
Yeah, I mean, it worked in Germany. They actually took this scheme from a German pilot scheme that worked very well. The site's going to be open from 7 p.m. until 5 a.m. It'll be very regulated.
In a kind of Swiss way.
In a very Swiss way, exactly. Only one person allowed in a car, and they'll drive in. And because what was happening was people were going to the city and sort of taking the prostitutes into the woods and into other parts, which was a lot more dangerous for everyone involved. And so this is sort of a scheme to try and see, well, maybe we can just contain this and keep it a lot safer and more regulated.
Obviously, the intentions are good, as you say, to regulate, to keep everything safer and less exploitation. But is anyone expressing concern or worried about this?
Definitely. I mean, a few people are. The prostitutes themselves are saying that the tightly controlled environment might intimidate some of their customers, which is quite a fair point. And also, I mean, it was quite an expensive scheme. It cost over 2 million francs, and it'll cost around 1 million francs to run them every year. And the amount given was 700,000. So some residents are complaining that it's quite an expensive scheme, but it was backed by a 52% majority in the first place.
So. All right, so they had a little referendum for
exactly.
this project.
Exactly, Swiss style again.
Let's move on to Le Figaro. Of course, something that we've covered on this program quite a bit is the crime situation in Marseille. Mm-hmm. Now it looks like they're asking for a bit of help.
Yes, so a group of locals who became very frustrated with the government's efforts to curb crime in Marseille have sort of launched a mock appeal to Batman called Un Batman pour Marseille. And it's basically a mock lobby saying that local politicians aren't doing enough. They come down from Paris, they hold meetings, create a lot of commotion, and then go back up north and kind of leave Marseille how it was before.
And do they really want a masked vigilante to sort themselves out, or is that shorthand for just a plea for someone to come and give them a hand?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And, I mean, especially in the past few months and weeks, the crime has been increasing in Marseille, despite it being the city of culture. Capital of Culture of 2013, and large initiatives, it doesn't seem to be working.
So what concrete steps is the city and local governments actually taking to try to fight off this rising crime?
Well, I mean, last week there was an attack on a pensioner, actually, and Ejo said that they were going to send down 130 extra riot police and officers during the week. But the problem is that a lot of the locals are saying they're not getting to the root of the problem, which is you have lots of immigrant societies, people left on the outskirts. It's not an inclusive type of government. So,
and that's very common to a lot of French cities. Mm. I mean, if you look at Paris, if you look at the immigrant communities in the banlieue and the tensions that can arise because of that separation between sort of rich inner city tribes and those on the outskirts. I mean, do you think there is a wider sense in Paris that this is a social inequity that needs to be addressed?
Definitely. It definitely is. And I think in Marseille, it's just a lot more marked because geographically you're right at, the border.
Yeah.
And Alexa, I think we have time for one more story. Last week on this program, we covered quite an interesting story when it came to the rise in bear attacks between Italy and Germany, I think it was. Switzerland, sorry. But now it looks like there's also a rise in wolf attacks in France.
Yeah, I mean, I guess European animals are kind of
What's
getting out of
summer?
Control. Well, there's been a large rise in wolf attacks in France. And one local official is saying that in France, no one knows how to hunt wolves. I mean, they deployed a 150 manhunt to cull animals in the region, and not one wolf was even found or killed. So, and you have sort of farmers going with night vision goggles, trying to kill wolves at night. And the local official actually is calling for US hunters because he says that they'll know much better how to handle the situation.
And what have the wolves actually been doing when they've been attacking? Have they been attacking humans or other animals? Or
no, mostly livestock. There's actually a threefold increase in the amount of livestock killed over the past year or so.
And is this just because there's a obviously the higher wolf population, but what's kind of behind this sudden change?
I think, like with the bears, it's protection laws, conservation laws. And so because the animals aren't being controlled and they're not having enough food in the local habitats, they're infringing on more civilian parts of the mountains.
Well, Alexa, we're going to have to leave it there. But thanks very much for coming on and having a look through this morning's European front pages. A very diverse mix of stories, to say the least. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Alad John, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mary Sophie Schwartzer, and our studio manager was Alex Funnel. Up next, after the news, is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. I'll be back with Poppy Trowbridge for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for me, Phil Hahn,
and me, Clemency Burton Hill. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.